So why is this Evolution Sunday? There is an organization called the Clergy Letter Project that has a number of signers to three forms of a letter about evolution in the face of people who expound on the biblical story as being the only explanation and the true story. And those of us clergy who have signed the letters are saying that we need to regard science as legitimate, as important to be taught in schools, and not as just one alternative among many. I just want to read one excerpt. The three versions are, there's a letter from rabbis, a letter from Christian ministers, and a letter from Unitarian Universalist ministers. And the signatures keep building over the years. This is just one excerpt from the Unitarian Universalist letter. We, the undersigned Unitarian Universalist clergy, believe that the timeless truths of the Bible and other scriptures may comfortably coexist with the discoveries of modern science. We believe that the story of evolution is a foundational scientific truth, one that has stood up to rigorous scrutiny and upon which much of human knowledge and achievement rests. To reject this truth or to treat it as one theory among others is to deliberately embrace scientific ignorance and transmit such ignorance to our children. We urge school board members to preserve the integrity of the science curriculum by affirming the teaching of the theory of evolution as a core component of human knowledge. We ask that science remain science and that religion remain religion, two very different but complementary forms of truth. I eagerly signed this letter when I read about it on the internet and promised to designate thenceforward one Sunday a year, and I usually do it around Darwin's birthday, which is February 12th, as Evolution Sunday. Speaking of science, I have loved astronomy deeply since I was 8 years old, but I was discouraged from thinking about making astronomy a career by those who saw my interest as inappropriate for a female. I grew up in the 1950s, as I know many of us did, and one of my frequent haunts was the Hayden Planetarium in Manhattan. I lived in Queens and rode the subways to the Hayden Planetarium and learned so much about how they did it that I could have done the lectures myself, I felt. But one time after a lecture, I ran up to the lecturer and said eagerly, I was probably 10 or 11, that I wanted to be an astronomer. He said to me, "Well, you're interested now, but you'll probably get married and have children." As if those two things are incompatible. But that was the attitude. I also remember writing to the planetarium because I had read that they had a pamphlet on becoming an astronomer. Excuse me. And I wrote away, got the pamphlet, and in the pamphlet it said, women are often also interested in astronomy, after it talked about men and their interests, but they often marry astronomers rather than become astronomers. It said that. I wish I still had that pamphlet in print. Well, despite these influences, I did find myself sometimes defiantly dreaming about becoming an astronomer. Perhaps I would have become one had it not been for the fact that I did not take that easily to the advanced mathematics in college that were required. But at that time, I was also very interested in philosophy and religion, as well as education, literature, and especially writing. So it made sense to me that I wound up in a pulpit instead of under an observatory dome. Still, Over the years, I have maintained an interest in astronomy as an amateur. If I were to take my telescope out just before dawn tomorrow morning, I could see what Galileo saw in the features of a couple of celestial objects, observations that in his day caused a major upheaval. Two of those objects, Jupiter and Venus, you can see shining brightly right now in the early morning. Venus just rising and Jupiter in the west, still high in the west. Galileo observed these two planets 400 years ago in his telescope between the years of 1609 and 1610. And what he saw convinced him that the church and the scientists of the time had it all wrong. When Galileo observed Jupiter through his improved telescope, he saw four bright objects close to Jupiter. And I can see these in my telescope today. There were four moons. And he watched them over several nights and noticed that they moved. And he could see that they moved around Jupiter. This was heresy, a viewpoint that shattered the prevailing belief that all celestial objects circled around the Earth. Galileo then turned his telescope to Venus and discovered that Venus had phases like our moon, which you need a telescope to see. These phases could only be explained if Venus moves around the sun and not around the Earth. Church officials and even some scientists of the time were so rooted to their preconceived beliefs that they questioned the optics of Galileo's telescope, or even thought that he was just playing tricks on them. Tonight we can see the moon cross the sky, rising at dusk and then high in the sky by 10 p.m. In his telescope, Galileo saw mountains, valleys, and other features on the moon, features that he saw change as the moon changes position with respect to the sun. This showed him that the moon is not a perfect, immutable sphere, as it was supposed to be, according to the church. You all know what happened to Galileo when he used these observations to challenge the authorities of his day. The church forced him to renounce his scientific claims, and he remained under house arrest for the rest of his life. As a young practicing Catholic and aspiring astronomer, I often thought about what looked to me, even centuries later, like an incompatibility between the fields of science and religion. On more than one occasion, I remember being in a Catholic confession booth asking the priest to help me reconcile such ideas as, for instance, the scientific fact of evolution and the scriptural account of creation. Their answers that, for instance, the 6 days of creation in scripture is metaphorical, not literal, those answers satisfied me for a while. But as a teen, I became weary of other aspects of that faith, and I finally left the church. When I was in high school, I came across this little poem by Walt Whitman, a poet I admired and still very much enjoy. This is his poem, From Leaves of Grass. When I heard the learned astronomer, when the proofs, the figures, were ranged in columns before me, when I was shown the charts and the diagrams to add, divide, and measure them, when I, sitting, heard the astronomer where he lectured with much applause in the lecture room, how soon, unaccountable, I became tired and sick, till rising and gliding out, I wandered off by myself, looked in the mystical moist night air, and from time to time looked in perfect silence at the stars. Well, as a passionate amateur astronomer, I found this poem of my hero Whitman to be disappointing. Whitman contrasts the lecture of the astronomer with the raw beauty of the unexplained stars and finds the lecture lacking. I remember thinking, I would have stayed and heard the whole lecture, because even the facts and figures of a scientific lecture for me contain beauty and mystery. The astronomy lectures I attended in those days were like religious services to me, in many ways more meaningful than the church services that I had gone to. Perhaps Whitman's particular lecturer was just very dull and drained all the beauty out of the science. Science certainly can be beautiful. Nowadays, there are many scientists who experience a kind of beauty, a sense of awe, a religious or mystical feeling when they study and contemplate the laws and workings of the universe. I am no scientist, but I have had religious feelings aroused in me when reading about the new physics or when looking up at the stars, comets, planets, and galaxies with the naked eye or through a telescope. It is amazing to me that we live in a universe that is not haphazard and inconsistent, but one that is governed by the laws of physics, a universe in which science and mathematics work. In his book, The Mind of God, physicist Paul Davies writes, "Science is a noble and enriching quest that helps us to make sense of the world. It does not deny a meaning behind existence. On the contrary, the fact that science works and works so well points to something profoundly significant about the organization of the cosmos. The scientific quest is a journey into the unknown. Each advance brings new and unexpected discoveries. But through it all, he says, runs the familiar thread of rationality and order. The cosmic order is underpinned by definite mathematical laws that interweave each other to form a subtle and harmonious unity. The laws are possessed of an elegant simplicity and have often commended themselves to scientists on grounds of beauty alone." Beauty alone, says the scientist. There is great beauty in science and mathematics, and many scientists have recognized it. To ignore the discoveries of science in favor of a literalist religious worldview, as some people amazingly still do, like those who continue to claim that biological evolution can't be true because the Bible seems to say otherwise, is myopic and self-delusional. But likewise, I would say that to embrace only a mechanistic scientific materialism, which asserts that all phenomena can be explained in terms of the actions of material components, even love and altruism, which are in this view just chemical states in the brain or adaptive functions of evolution, this too strikes me as too narrow. There is a ground beyond scientific materialism and religious fundamentalism, a ground where science and religion, cosmologies and theologies, experiments and mystical insights can meet and converse and inspire each other. Albert Einstein said that religion without science is lame and that science without religion is blind. I would add that science without religion can be empty and dry, even tragic, if it recognizes only a cold, purposeless, indifferent universe and sees our amazing existence and our human consciousness as mere accidents. What I mean by religion is not a set of creeds, but an attitude of receptiveness to a sense of awe and wonder, an openness to the mystery which lies at the center of being, behind the discoveries of science. Cosmologists are getting closer to explaining the first moments of the universe, and some theoretical models speculate, with the laws of quantum physics to back them up, that the cosmos was self-creating, emerging naturally 15 billion years ago out of the superdense singularity, an infinitesimal point where space, energy, and time are all collapsed together. The singularity exploded and became our universe of space, matter, and energy. And this universe has been expanding ever since. A self-creating model of the universe requires no need for a prime mover, a god, to set it going. For some scientists, this idea may put the need for a god or for any spiritual or mystical dimension completely to rest. But other scientists point out that the great mysteries are still there. Why is there a universe at all? And where do the laws and the exquisite mathematical equations of physics come from? As physicist Stephen Hawking put it, why does the universe go through all the bother of existing? As a theology professor I once heard lecture put it, another provocative way to put it, why is there not nothing? Think about it. Stephen Hawking asks, what is it that breathes fire into the equations and makes a universe for them to describe? In the final analysis, I believe that science can bring us right to the brink of this mystery, but it definitely doesn't answer it, nor can it. This why is a religious question. In his book, God and the Astronomers, scientist Robert Jastrow says that scientists have solved one mystery after another, right back to the moment of the Big Bang, but they can't go back beyond that. He writes, for the scientist who has lived by faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. Scientists have scaled the mountains of ignorance and are about to conquer the highest peak. As they pull themselves over the final rock, they are greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. The frontiers of modern science, particularly physics, are bumping up against the frontiers of new theologies these days. One 20th century theology took its inspiration from the work of the mathematician and philosopher Alfred North Whitehead, called process theology. That was not his term for it, but a later term. Whitehead sought to blend theology and quantum physics. Quantum physics, discovered near the beginning of the 20th century, introduced uncertainty and chance into our previously neatly predictable and deterministic universe. In process theology, the universe is a vast web of interconnected events, characterized by chance and change as well as order. All things are incomplete and are continually in the process of becoming, including God, for those process theologians who are theists, and some of them are not. The future of the process worldview is open. In this worldview is open. The future is open and not determined. All entities, therefore, be they humans or galaxies or elephants or quarks, all are interdependent, and the activities and choices of each create the universe anew in each moment of time. The process God does not direct events, but participates with beings in the creative process and lures or persuades them toward a positive direction. This idea of God certainly differs very much from the traditional static, perfect, distant, and all-powerful God most of us grew up with. It is one that I personally have much more resonance with. We can see possible evidence that the universe unfolds in a positive direction, as process theology says, when we look at how evolution on Earth has resulted in great diversity and increasingly complex forms. The physicist Freeman Dyson has suggested that the universe seems to be constructed in just the right way so as to result in maximum diversity. There is abundant cosmic diversity, many kinds of stars, galaxies, and nebulae, many varieties of particles and elements, and there is great diversity in biological life on this planet, and perhaps on other planets as well. Yet none of it would have come about if the universe were the slightest bit different from what it was at the beginning. If, for instance, as in the children's story, the rate of expansion of the universe were smaller by one part in 100,000 million million, or if the strong nuclear force, the force that holds the nuclei of an atom together, were a tiny, tiny amount weaker than it is, then there would have only been hydrogen in the universe. No stars, no planets, no life. And if the nuclear force were very slightly stronger than it is, all the hydrogen would have been converted to helium. In short, if any of a number of factors, speeds, temperatures, forces, were off by an unimaginably small, tiny amount, then the stars and the heavier elements could not have formed. And we wouldn't be here contemplating all of this. But the force was with us, to borrow a phrase, and here we are. As Stephen Hawking wrote, the odds against a universe like ours emerging out of something like the Big Bang are enormous. I think, he says, there are clearly religious implications. Hawking is an avowed atheist, yet he finds himself at the brink of the religious when contemplating the fact that we exist at all. This awesome universe of ours breathes to the rhythm of elegant equations, glows bright with mystery and meaning, and shines forth with exquisite beauty and diversity. That we are here, a part of it all, is an amazing, astounding miracle. I want my religious insights to be informed by science, and my scientific understandings to be infused with religious meaning. I want to listen to what the learned astronomer has to say, and then go outside and look up in perfect silence at the stars.